It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
You guys, I was thinking about this. If I had to tease out one single common thread linking all our gutsy guests together, it's a fascinating form, I would say, of fearlessness. Because fear is exactly the reason a lot of people don't succeed. Example, if you had a great idea in the middle of a recession, would you think to yourself, hey, let me max out my credit cards and turn this into a business? You know, the average person would say, no way, I'm totally scared. I'll lose my current job. I'm scared it'll fail. I'm afraid this is the worst time to take a chance. But average, you don't want to be average, right? Neither did my guest today, who during high school dove into his passion to be a tech mastermind of sorts, and in doing so became, at age 15, the youngest engineer ever to be hired at software giant Oracle. 15 years old. You know, he could have ended it there, right? Making a fine living at a tech blue chip for the rest of his life, climbing the ladder, doing well for the rest of time. I mean, why take the chance and reach higher when life is good enough? But even at a young age, he had one mission, and that was to move himself and the world forward. Here with me today is the co-founder and CEO of a company called Samsara, Sanjeet Biswa. Sanjeet, thank you for coming on Everyone Talks to Liz. I was so psyched to hear your story.
Thanks, Liz. It's great to be on.
15? Are you kidding me? I mean, how did you get on Oracle's radar at 15 years old?
You know, it's funny. That feels like ancient history. I think that was about 25 years ago. But I think, you know, we probably had some family friends who were working at Oracle. I'd heard of the company. And I basically submitted a resume, not really thinking that a partial high school education may not have been enough. But they saw that I'd been writing code, and I think they got excited.
I wonder if that would happen today.
You know, I think there are a lot more techie kids out there these days. Back then, it was still kind of a rare, very nerdy art form. So I think I stood out a little bit. I think now would be a lot harder.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. But, you know, that's the thing. Who knows at what point in time we all exist? And that's why you have to strike, even if you don't think the iron's hot, right?
That's right. You know, and I think at that point, there was just this sort of blind desire or passion to go and learn more and learn from everyone I could. So I didn't even think twice about it, to be honest.
How did you scale that? I mean, your parents were okay with this? I know they were both professors, correct?
That's right. Yeah. My family is a bunch of academics. My dad had moved into industry by that point, and so he knew that there was a lot of exciting engineering work going on in the software industry. But I think they were okay with it because they saw that I was engaged. I was learning a ton. And I think they just wanted to kind of feed my brain.
Okay, that is fascinating to me, as is your earlier life. But I did just want, because I think it's important for our listeners to know this, because they're saying, Liz, what is Samsara? It's not a household name, your company, but there's a good chance many of our listeners have unknowingly been the beneficiaries of what the company does in the Internet of Things world, right? IoT?
That's right. So our technology helps the companies in the world of physical operations. So if you think about the supply chains or the energy utilities, the construction companies that really power this planet, we're basically helping them become safer, more efficient, more sustainable using data from IoT sensors and all kinds of other inputs like mobile apps and web apps and so on. So what we're really doing is becoming the technology partner behind the scenes that helps these companies. And these companies, by the way, make up about 40% of the world GDP. So you're exactly right. Many of your listeners probably have benefited from the customers that we help support.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, just to sort of clarify, you make GPS and temperature monitoring, dash cams that provide visibility into driver behavior, which then, it would make sense, offer insights to help decrease the frequency of preventable accidents by a pretty significant amount. But let's talk about what you just said, you know, behind the scenes. You're kind of the man behind the curtain. And I guess you probably look at it that way, too. You grew up in Texas, but your parents had come to Canada from another country. Can you just give us the map there?
Yeah, absolutely. So my parents are originally from India, They immigrated to Canada, where my dad was finishing a postdoc at the University of Alberta. He then went on to become a professor at SMU, Southern Methodist University, down in Dallas, Texas. Mm. So that's really where I grew up. So we moved there when I was about two. I went to school there until we moved to California, which is right around the time of high school.
Texas. What was that like?
You know, I think it was pretty good. In retrospect, it was pretty hot. And, you know, that's kind of Texas's reputation. But yeah. I had a great great childhood. I think I was fortunate. I went to a great public school down there, made a lot of friends. And it was a great place to grow up.
Texas is very different, though, from California. I find it so fascinating. Nowadays, people are leaving California and going to Austin and to Houston.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really been interesting. When we moved to California in the mid-1990s, Silicon Valley was the place to be in technology, right? You know, all the tech giants, Apple, Cisco, and all these big companies were out here. Now you can join a tech company basically anywhere in the U.S. and really anywhere in the world. So I think opportunity has spread out a lot more than it had, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember Gateway Computers. They were up in the Northwest, way up there in, Idaho? I can't even remember. But
I do just remember those cows.
Yeah, the cow box.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. The computers with the cow box name. All right. So, you know, we already mentioned that your parents were both professors. And I know I'm jumping around, but I find in a way that you had done that, too, in your life. I want to go back to your high school. You're all in on technology, right? I mean, you created a web team at your school. What year was this and what did that web team do?
Yeah, you know, I think this was 1994, 1995. And for all of your listeners who remember, that's kind of before the internet had become mainstream. I remember I'd sort of read about it, somehow figured out how to get online. And this is when I was in probably ninth grade. And just thought it was amazing. You had access to all this information. You could send emails. You could chat with people. It was really just this kind of mind-blowing new technology. And I thought it'd be a great idea to basically start a club in my high school. We called it very creatively the web team, and get a bunch of us together to try to figure out a way to get all the other students in our high school online. So we had about 1,600 kids in our high school.
Okay.
And we thought, you know, how can we get them online? And so we created email addresses for them all. We made it easy for them to make web pages. And now that I think back on it, it was a little bit out there because it's not like the World Wide Web had become mainstream. The web browser had just been invented that year. And it's actually funny now how life has worked out. I remember downloading the first web browser, which was called Mosaic. It was written by a student at the University of Illinois named Mark Andreessen, who's now on my board. It's really funny to see all that kind of come full circle.
That is amazing. I mean, Andreessen is huge in Silicon Valley. Big investor, big venture capitalist now. Talk to me about that moment, though, because making web pages to me sounds a little Facebooky. I mean, you were Facebook before Facebook was Facebook, it seems like. Or do I have that completely way off?
You know, I'd never really made that connection. This is over a decade before Facebook. So this is really at the very beginning of the internet and when people still had never really seen a web page and a web browser. So I think in that sense, it was just a way to get people online. But you're right, now it's kind of synonymous with Facebook and social networking and social media. But back then it was simply, you know, can you get people onto the internet?
I'm thinking about that dial-up sound. Back in the day, CompuServe, Pascal. I went to Berkeley in the late 80s, and I just remember that Pascal, people were learning that, but they had to take turns on the three computers that the computer science lab actually had. So, you know, you are very, very early in all of this. And then you just found your passion. So you ended up at Stanford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was late 90s, early 2000s.
What was your major?
Well, this is going to sound very out there, but it was computer science and electrical engineering. So basically building blocks of computers.
Did you imagine that you were going to be a founder of a company? Tell me what your mindset was.
Well, you know, that was actually during the dot-com boom. So there were companies being founded left and right, you know, just around the Stanford campus. So Palo Alto was very much kind of an epicenter of that tech wave. However, as you probably remember, that wave kind of busted in 2001, which is the year before I graduated. So that was a kind of time of reckoning for a lot of people where everyone that was graduating with me was figuring out, well, am I going to be able to find a job? Where am I going to work? And for me, I'd actually found a passion as an undergraduate student doing research, and probably not surprising given my parents' background and my extended family, a bunch of academic researchers. So I'd kind of gotten into that. And I thought, you know what, this is actually a great opportunity to go into grad school. It's not like there are any jobs out there anyway. And so let me take a couple of years and do a PhD program. So that's how I ended up applying to grad school in the sort of wake of the dot-com bust. And I started grad school in 2002, which is the year after.
Right. And that was at MIT, correct?
That's right. So I moved to the East Coast there.
Well, when you look at that experience, because MIT, I lived in Boston and we used to cover the kids at Harvard and the kids at Northeastern and of course MIT. And I always used to say, oh my God, those kids at MIT are the smartest. Really unbelievable brains there. What was the number one thing that you learned there among your peers, among all these people who were very, very intelligent, obviously, that really helps you to this day?
Well, I learned a ton in grad school at MIT, and it is a great institution. It's this amazing melting pot of so many bright minds and professors and researchers and so on. For me, the biggest takeaway was actually the importance of the problem you're solving. So not just the solution and the clever engineering and math and science that goes into it, but working on the right problem is just as important, if not more important. And that was something that I ended up learning in my very first year there. I remember I kind of hit the ground. I was excited to write papers and just dive headfirst into research. And our academic advisor, a PhD advisor, said, you know, the papers will come. Let's go find something interesting to work on. And so that's how we ended up getting into the research that became our first startup company, which was a research project called MIT RoofNet. We wanted to take new technology at the time, which was Wi-Fi, and make really big Wi-Fi networks that could connect hundreds of thousands of people. That was a challenging and interesting problem. There's a lot of technical know-how that needs to go into making big networks. But it wasn't something that was going to produce a paper that year. And that was okay. And so I really loved that MIT sort of taught us that. And that was very much part of the culture, which was just work on big, hard problems and the rest will sort of work itself out.
It does, if you just keep going. This is Everyone Talks to Liz, and we will be right back.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
I want to talk about the first company you founded, Meraki, because you started it just before the 2008 recession. So things are good. Things are flush, I would imagine. We're all recovering from the dot-com implosion and that bubble bursting. And this is a company that you ended up being sold to Cisco for $1 billion. But I need to hear what it was like in the early days, because that sounds great, but I'm sure there were some difficult times.
Well, there certainly were a lot of challenges. The first of which was actually starting the company, because like we just talked about, we were grad students and researchers. Mm-hmm. We didn't know the first thing about starting a business and raising financing. And we were out in Boston, which was not Silicon Valley. So it's not like there were angel investors everywhere. So the first and kind of biggest challenge that Meraki faced was getting off the ground. So we actually ended up bootstrapping the company. In other words, we sold product and generated revenue in a way that we could reinvest it back in the business. Sounds really straightforward, but when you're building hardware technology and cloud services and doing this all, you know, about 15 years ago, that was a pretty big undertaking. So that was challenge number one. And then, like you just said, running the company and growing it through the aftermath of the 2008 recession, that was also challenging, but really sort of a crucible or formative moment for us, because we learned the importance of solving real world business problems, connecting with our customers, or running a feedback loop. And that's what made those products so successful. And they continue to grow today. There's now, I think, 4 million plus Meraki networks in the world, which means there have been billions of dollars of Meraki products sold, which is really mind blowing to think about.
Okay. So again, I need to go back to the early stages. You said you didn't know anything about raising money or starting a business. Where did you buy an office? Did you rent? Where were you manufacturing? How did you get your first customer? Were you cold calling? Let us know.
Yeah, well, we certainly didn't buy our first office. We didn't have any money, so there wasn't a lot of buying of anything. The way we kind of got off the ground was, it was very much sort of a where there's a will, there's a way kind of thing. We had this idea that we want to take the technology we developed in grad school, basically put it in a box so other people could build networks and provide free Wi-Fi and, you know, connect their schools and their main streets and so on. So that was the vision and the dream. To make it happen, we needed to actually make some routers, so hardware devices that would provide the Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. We need to hire some software engineers. We basically had a lot of friends from grad school who were excited to work on this as a commercial project. So that part we had covered. But then we needed to finance it all. And so in that sense, the biggest challenge that we had to go through at the very beginning was simply finding, I think it was about $50,000 or $100,000 to make that first order for the hardware. Mm-hmm. And then
Hold on. How'd you find it?
Well, we tried everything. So we had no money. We were grad students living off very tiny stipends. So that wasn't really an option. And none of us had, you know, parents that had extra money for kind of projects like that. So we ended up first trying the banks. And I remember going into what was called Fleet Bank at the time. You may remember that.
Sure.
I remember going to Fleet Bank and asking, is it possible for us to get a loan, or is there anything that we can kind of figure out? And they looked at me and they said, look, you know, I was probably 24 at the time. They said, look, you guys are in your mid-20s. Now, if you were starting a pizza joint, like if you needed to buy a pizza oven, we could finance that. But routers, we don't know. We can't do that. So that wasn't an option. And we ended up actually finding our first two customers. There was a nonprofit called One Laptop Per Child, and they wanted to put Wi-Fi out in some of these villages and remote parts of the world. And then Google, of all places, had announced that they want to do free Wi-Fi in the city of San Francisco. So I ended up pitching them inadvertently. I did an academic presentation to them about our research. And at the end, I showed them one slide that said, you know, this is a project we're working on. We'd love to kind of get it started, but we're trying to figure out how to get our first order of routers out the door. And Google actually placed an order for a couple of thousand units. And so that was basically our first purchase order. Or PO.
Oh, my. Were you guys high-fiving each other and so psyched when you got that first order?
We were definitely excited. And, you know, it was funny because actually somebody from the audience came up and said, hey, I want to give you a PO for 3,000 units. And I said, that's great. What's a PO? So it was only at the point that we figured out that was purchase order that we're like, amazing. This is going to be awesome.
You're like, yeah, I know. I know what a PO is. Yeah. Meantime, you're desperately
well, then
looking
we had to
at
figure
it.
Out how do you cash one of these things. So then we learned about, you know, the whole back office side of things too.
And once you sold it, you made it through the recession, and you sell it to Google. You can't get it out of your system, right? That entrepreneurial spirit, and that's where Samsara came about. I know that the Financial Times last year named Samsara the second fastest growing tech company in America out of 500. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's kind of fun to see those metrics, but when you're in the middle of it, you're not thinking about that. You're just trying to think about the next quarter and the next year.
And let's talk about some really less than exciting moments, I'm sure, aren't too much fun, or maybe they are, to go back and look upon, like times where maybe you felt you weren't going to be able to make payroll. It's not easy, is it? This road to really creating something.
No, it's really not. And I think, you know, we've had more of these moments than I think any of us would like. I remember back in 2008 and 2009, the world was kind of falling apart, right? The banks were failing. And unemployment ended up spiking well over 10%. It was a time that was pretty tough if you're a startup company, which we were at Meraki. We were only doing a few million dollars in revenue. And you're trying to figure out how to maintain a really high growth rate when you know that it's a really tough time out there in the economy. So that was kind of first tough moment. And then we had another one recently in 2020, the beginning of the pandemic. That mm-hmm. was chaos, and we had to lead through it. And, you know, there are just these moments where you have to figure out what's important. How do you think clearly, and how do you stay focused on customers, on developing the business, and kind of the fundamentals, the things that matter?
What is the most important thing not to do in times like that?
Well, I think there's a lot coming at you, right? You've got a lot of different stakeholders to think about, whether it's customers or employees or investors. Mm. And so kind of staying calm and figuring out, okay, what is going to get us out of this in a productive way that we can work hard and deliver value. And if we do our jobs and we kind of stay focused on those things, the rest will work itself out. I think that is the hardest thing, because there are all these news headlines that are doom and gloom. There's a lot of panic out there. But if you're doing something that's fundamentally useful and has value, you can build a model around it that is sustainable. And that's always been the key thing that I stay focused on, is where is our core value and how do we double down on that?
As you grow this company and maybe a few others in your future, you know, when people really make it and they are billionaires now, I mean, you're hugely successful. Don't you often think about what you can do that's more important than, you know, the current selling your wares and making sure you have more customers and growing a business and maybe taking it public one day? You know, I think about Silicon Valley, and the one thing that I notice, and believe me, I'm all about meritocracy. I'm about who can get the job done. But one thing that I continue to hear from people in the Valley is that women are not given the same shot as men. Is there anything that you look at to try and change something like that?
Absolutely. So one of our core values as a company is to be inclusive. And that means inclusive women, minorities, veterans, all different kinds of folks that come from different walks of life. And I think if you have experienced the kind of deck being stacked against you, you know what that's like. And for me, you know, I was children of immigrants. My name didn't sound like everyone else's. It wasn't a John or a Bill or something like that. I didn't come from a business background. And so in some ways, the odds felt stacked against me. Now, don't get me wrong. I had a ton of advantages in terms of a great education and great parents and all that kind of stuff. But for me, it was actually a sort of moment as I was growing up where you realize, you know, it's not always going to be easy. And so then when you get a chance to build an organization, define some of those values, figure out what you're going to consider important, you have an opportunity to try to stack the deck again in a more even way, right? And so that's what being inclusive means for us, is kind of opening that funnel up or opening that mindset up. But then to your point earlier about meritocracy, you do want to make sure you build a great high performance team. So for us, that means making sure we have a very diverse top of funnel when we recruit for different positions, and then kind of letting the process run and making sure that there are no pinch points where, you know, statistically things aren't making sense, if that kind of works out for you.
Yeah, because I do feel that one of the things that I continue to hear is this drumbeat of questioning. I wouldn't say complaints, but questioning as to why venture capitalists tend to just toss money at men versus women. And so therefore, I often think about that. And I think it's an important issue to bring up. Regardless, as we finish up, Sanjit, what is it, if you were to tell kids today who are in high school, just like you were, and starting up your little web team, what would you tell all high school kids, whether they're interested in technology or not?
Well, I would probably tell them, stay focused on impact. And so whether that's the web team and you're just trying to get people online and get them email addresses, or the RoofNet project and we were trying to get people Wi-Fi access, or now Samsara, where we're trying to go and change the world of physical operations by helping give them data about how things are going out in the field on safety and efficiency and sustainability. All of those projects for me have been about impact. And if you can stay focused on that, you can create some value in the world. And if you create value in the world, the business and the startup and all that kind of, the kind of details work themselves out. So if you figure out that North Star, it really helps, because there will be all kinds of things thrown at you. And, you know, these projects tend to take decades. They're not short-term sprints. They're really long-term marathons. And so you want to make sure you're headed in the right direction and you know how to reorient yourself when you do get knocked off course a little bit.
Yeah, because everybody does. It's almost like you can't really become a huge success without getting knocked off course and then finding your way again. Sanjit, what a great story. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Liz.
We'll continue to watch all of the developments, certainly over at Samsara. And thank you guys, as always, for tuning in, because I think these stories are changing your lives and your world so that you hear it's not easy. The climb is really rife with all kinds of boulders and cliffs and edges. It's okay. So you fall off. You're holding on by your fingernails. All successful people do. Once again, I love you guys for tuning in. Everyone talks to Liz. And by the way, I talk to you guys Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern on Fox Biz for the Clayman Countdown. I'll see you then. Want to listen ad-free? You can do it with a Fox News Podcasts Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And then Amazon Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.